Okay, we're recording the review lesson for Megillat Esther. This is actually, as I explained to you at the beginning of the semester, a segment that I have not taught before at Stern, so it's the first semester we've been doing it. So I hope that's been something that you've all appreciated, because it really has been a challenge, but at the same time something very, I hope, very exciting. The way this lesson works, firstly, just to mention the semester, we're talking about the fall semester 2018. Let's get it on the record. And it's a Book of Esther, M section. I think your exam, I'm sorry to tell you, is on a Sunday. How sacrilegious can one get? But that's just the way it is. Hopefully I will be there, Blinader, depending on the weather, and who knows what's going to be in January. So I look forward to seeing you all on that bright and wonderful day. Before we get into just talking a little bit about the review sheet, which I sent to you, I just want to talk a little bit about the exam thing. What I mean by that is a number of basic instructions. Many have heard this spiel before, but I have to go through it just to make sure everybody understands. You will have a two-hour exam. It will be covering six questions altogether, and your task is to complete 5 out of 6. Okay, don't be brave or otherwise, I use the word foolhardy, if I knew what it meant. Don't be foolhardy to finish 6, because it doesn't really get you anywhere. Essays or question number 6 just gets a red line through it, because I really do not have the time to, you know, sort of judge which one's better than the other. I just won't grade it. Do 5, come and sign your life away as you do when you sign the paper, and then off you go. Yes. No, that's an important point. I'm going to mention that. It can be done in any order that you wish. Okay? So I would make it very clear, you'll get these delightful little, presumably they're still blue little books. On the front cover, just write your name. Please use the books as much as you need. Don't worry about conserving the environment, because the use of an extra book is not going to make that much of a difference to the world, but it might make a big difference to your exam. Why do I say that? It's because I have a lot of these stories, which many of you will have heard, of one wonderful young lady who's probably now a grandmother, because it must have been 20 years ago, that she decided to write her essay on the back cover. Quite extraordinary. Started on the back cover, the blue cover, I'm talking about the cover itself, on the inside, and finished it on the outside of the back cover with about 1 millimeter to spare. It was quite an extraordinary effort. Did not endear herself to me whatsoever, but I thought just worth mentioning to you, please don't do that. If you get to the point where you're finishing booklet number one, then, and you even have just one word to write, to add to your answer, please take booklet number two, just mark them at the front, number one, number two, and, you know, as they say in England, Bob's your uncle, everything is fine. So I want to make that absolutely clear, and so there should be no discussion about that. Use the margins, make it a good presentation, you know, don't sort of make it scrappy, try and make it as neat as you can. In terms of pencil or pen, I would prefer you to write in pen, but really up to you. If you want to write it in pencil, all well and good, but please, as I told you, or I might have told one of the classes, not in psychedelic colours. And if you don't know what psychedelic means, you may have to look it up. It means anything which is like off the page. You know, I once had a bright pink pen that was used, which was only legible in the dark. I mean, I think I mentioned the story to you. Very difficult to grade unless it was like 12 o'clock at night in a very dark room. So not really such... I don't make these stories up. These are for real. It's unbelievable. So when you actually do the exam, please make sure you do it in legible writing implement. Very important point about the questions is that every question is in parts. So you'll have 1, A, B, and C. Please do not, under any circumstance, miss out any of the parts. Even if you're not sure about part B, write something, because you can do brilliant answers for A and C, but if you write nothing for part B, I can't give you any points for it. All right? If you write something, you'll get some points, whatever happens, and points are really important, as you probably understand, I'm sure you do. So basically, make sure that you write answers to every part. Read the paper carefully. Okay? Yes, question?
If you wanted to answer in essay form, like short
Yeah, you'll see how it goes. Some of them are more essays, some of them are shorter. It's really, you'll see as the questions are in front of you, you'll probably work that one out for yourself. But I don't think any question is like a yes or no answer. I think there are requirements of some sort of paragraph for most questions, but not, you know, sort of 10 pages on each question. That's not the way to go. Also, just make sure again, in terms of whether you want to use one side of the page or both sides is up to you. You know, I really don't have an opinion about that. And as we said before, it can be answered in any order that you wish. Okay, depending on how you feel at the time. Is there another question or should we go on? Yes, please. How many to answer? It's really up to you. There's no fixed amount. All right, some will require a longer presentation. The question I do get very often, which is a good question, is what happens if A, B, and C all can be answered in one paragraph, in one answer, right? So to that, I would say you can do that. Just make it clear that you're answering all three parts in one shot, in one paragraph. Okay, make clear what you're doing. Once you've done that, then, you know, as my grandmother used to say, gesundheit, just go ahead and do what you have to do. Okay? Any other questions on that one? All right. In terms of timing, it usually runs, obviously it does run to 2 hours. There are a number of you with extra time, which will be accommodated very easily. It'll be finished at 3. We'll take you down to the room downstairs and you'll finish it in the whatever that room is called, the extra time room. What I would say to you is that the average timing is around an hour, between an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half. Most people finish within that time, so don't, you know, sort of spoil it for yourself by trying to rush it. There is literally no rush, particularly on Sunday afternoon, unless you've got theatre tickets, but I would suggest probably put them off for a week. The issue of finishing on time always reminds me, again, I have to tell these stories, even though I've been telling them for years, of the young lady who, again, probably is a grandmother at this point, who decided to do her exam flying to Israel at 5 o'clock in the evening, finishing the exam at 3. And she had to be in JFK for a 5 o'clock flight. A bit of a crazy system. What she was thinking, I really do not know. And as a consequence, I think she made the plane, but she didn't make the exam. 20 minutes and she was out of the door and compromised her whole grade and that. Nothing I could do. So please don't do that. You know, if you've got somewhere to go, give yourself plenty of time to finish the exam without putting yourself into any sort of pressurized situation. Not worth it. So that's in terms of exam technique. Books. Bringing books to the exam. I do encourage to bring a text. Okay? I don't think they're allowing you in terms of your computers or whatever. That all stays closed. But what I would allow, is a Hebrew-English Tanakh. Right, not the red book or the pink book or whatever color it is these days, the one that some of you have purchased, but a regular Hebrew English, maybe JPS, could be a Koran, could be the Art Scroll, the green one, the very big volume, which is literally a Hebrew English translation. Don't mind any of those. But anything with commentary in English, no. If you have a Tanakh, which is pure Hebrew, Mikraot Gedolot, then that is acceptable. Okay, I don't have a problem with bringing in a volume like that. But anything like the Judaica that we've been using, no, that's not allowed. Okay, so again, make sure you have a text. I would say a text is going to be useful because ideally in a question where you feel you can add to the question by quoting from the text, that's obviously the thing to do. And if you want to highlight your book beforehand, that would also be acceptable. I have no problem with that. So if you want to mark out particular pieces of the story which you would use in an answer, if you think it would be relevant, then I have no problem with you doing that before the exam, bringing that in. But no textbook that we are using, the one, the Judaica Press, is not acceptable. Again, JPS or Koran, any Hebrew-English translation. Okay? If you get... Sorry? Oh, Megillat Esther, correct. If you are really desperate, can't find anything, then bottom line, you can certainly print out a Hebrew-English translation from Sfari or something like that, but it's got to be a printer. I can't let you use the computer during the exam. That's clearly not acceptable. So again, that's just the requirement, I would say. Not, again, not a requirement, but a very strong recommendation. Okay? Any questions? Yes, shall
obviously, not like this. I know sometimes, like, maps, like, we'll have, like, a tiny bit.
Yeah, don't worry about that. The art scroll has that, but it's not gonna change your life. Okay? So not a problem. Not a problem. You bring that in. But again, I can't allow the Judaica because that's pretty extensive. Yes, Ali. Yes, fine. I don't have an issue, but as long as it's only Hebrew English and nothing more than that. All right? So,
yeah.
And if you want to highlight bits to which you would use in an answer, you know, bakasha, don't have a problem with that. Okay? Any other questions before we move on? All right, I think we've covered the basic exam technique. You've got to be in for the first 45 minutes, as far as I remember. Then if you finish, you can leave. But as I said, usually a good average is around an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half. And there's always a nice group of people who are in for the 2 hours. All right, at this point, what I'm going to do is go look at the review sheet. If there are no more questions on exam, I'm trying to think what else I can tell you. In terms of grading, the grading is done pretty quickly, much as I can. You've got the exam on the Sunday. I would like to think by the end of that week you will have your grades. Don't forget there's also sort of other components to the grades. So again, for those who haven't received your essay, that's really important to get that finished and done and in my hand as soon as you can. If for any reason you're doing overtime and I'm not around, then you hand the essay in to whoever is proctoring and they will get it to me. It's usually emailed to me afterwards, so that's the way the system usually works. If you have any special arrangements to ask for, some girls have asked me, not in this class, I think in other classes, then I cannot grant that directly, but you have to go and speak to Dr. Katz, who is the Jewel Katz, who is running the exam program, and she will try and work it out with you. Right? She's quite amenable to a limited extent. Any points that people want to raise? I think we've covered most of the exam technique. Okay. All right. I don't know where the exam will be. My guess is probably be in the auditorium, but you'll find out nearer the time. All right. Now, let's have a look at the page of the review. What I brought with me, and I hope you've kept the color, I've just got one copy of each, so I can't really give these out, is the bunch of handouts. I looked with quite amazement that we've gone through almost 20 handouts during the semester, which I think is pretty intense. And what I've tried to do, and this is really introduction to number one, I've tried, as I said at the beginning of the semester, and back in those warm days of August, I tried to explain to you that we're learning Megillat Esther from a very different perspective. And not that we're excluding our traditional style of learning Megillat Esther, but I wanted to make it clear that I wanted to take a different approach, and I found the approach that I was enamored with was given over by Rav Lau, Benny Lau, who teaches and is a rabbi in Yerushalayim. Has a wonderful book on the Megillah, which I don't know, I haven't seen it on sale anywhere in this country, but is certainly available in bookstores in Israel, and is a very inspiring commentary, something very different. So if you look at number one, the historical approach, Xerxes and his battle. So we asked from the beginning the very basic question that we all know the story of Megillat Esther is something that we've grown up with, but have we ever put it into a historical perspective? In other words, who was Ahasuerus? Right? Did Esther and Mordechai, what were they? What were their characters like? What were they all about from day one? Okay, trying to sort of get to grips maybe with some of the questions that we've always had, but never quite verbalize them the way that maybe one has been able to with this particular approach. I'll give you an example. One thing that always bothered me was the Midrash, which tells me that Mordechai was in the army with Haman. Right? That's something I heard a long time ago. But it never squared in my mind with the concept of Mordechai being the Gadol HaDor, sort of the holiest rabbi of the generation. If he is such a great rabbi, what is he doing in the Persian army fighting one of the battles of Achashverosh? And if it is a battle of Achashverosh, what are we talking about? Which battle? Right? So already you start questioning who Achashverosh is, what battle. We know it's the Persian Empire, so we've got records, historical records of the Persian battles. So before you go anywhere, you begin to understand that this story has a historical context. Right? I want to make that very clear. Historical context, which does give us a very different, spin. It gives us a very different approach to the whole book of Megillat Esther. All right, and I hope that point is sort of, you know, it was repeated maybe too often. I don't know, but I'm glad that at least I'm hoping that has registered with you to understand Megillat Esther from a historical perspective. Okay, so that was really the first thing that we did. And you'll see, number one on your sheet, Xerxes and his battles. So again, I hope all of you have the timesheet, the timeline that I gave you on day one, which basically starts the whole process of looking at the time frame. All right, and again, even before we get to the story of Megillah, what are we talking about? Achashverosh being a leader of the Persian Empire, that's something which we know. And the whole context of what the story of Purim, where is it happening outside Eretz Israel, it's happening in Persia, it's happening in Shushan, and very much the background to this is the original decrees that were made regarding rebuilding the Second Temple. All right? One of the things that Rav Lau argues so strongly is that when we try to put some sort of date on the Megillah, when it happened, right, you'll see you can read very erudite articles all over the place and they will be struggling to give you some sort of exact time frame for the Megillah. And Rav Lau suggested, okay, and very interestingly as far as I'm concerned, that there is a period of time between the permission to go back to Eretz Israel, which was given by King Cyrus, one of the first Persian kings, who conquered the Babylonians. Right, remember, Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonia, all right, conquered the temple, destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, took the Jews into exile. 70-year exile, and of course the question is from when till when, and again, Rav Lau had suggestions about that. I hope you've got something written down, we did speak about that. But you get to the year 539 BCE, and 539 BCE, we know, is a very significant date. It's corroborated in historical writings that it's the date when Cyrus conquers Babylon, 539. So all of a sudden, Persia takes over from the Babylonians. At that point, Cyrus, Koresh, who is a completely different personality to Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian kingdom. Cyrus is a man who seems to be much more, I suppose nowadays you would call him more of a liberal, if that's the way to describe him, probably not, but you know what I mean. Much more open-minded, wanted to allow a lot of the people that had been taken in by the Babylonians to go back and re-establish themselves in their own countries, and this of course affected the Jewish people. And in 538, a year after Cyrus came to power, he gave the order for the Jews to return to Eretz Israel, and we know that at the beginning a small number of Jews went, right, on the page that I gave you, it's recorded here in the middle of the page, and in essentially two communities developed, community in Eretz Israel, which at the time was very small, and the community in Babylon, which remained as big as it was, or now was taken over by the Persians. So, of course, the Jews moved from Babel, they went into Persia, and spread out through the 127 countries, as we know. So, what happened initially, and again, just to explain this, is that the Jews did not do very well at the beginning. All right, they didn't heed the call of Cyrus. Cyrus said, go and rebuild your temple, and they didn't go. All right, and those who went were very much hindered by what happened. They couldn't rebuild the temple. So, you've got the year 538. And you've got a period, right, which runs from the year 538 down approximately 65 years, okay, which gets you to 533, 473. 473 is the year when we are told Ezra came back to Eretz Israel and began to galvanize the people to finish the Second Temple project. You've got 65 years between the time when the temple was, the building project was essentially stopped, and you can read all about that. It wasn't necessarily out of choice, but there were a number of factors there. And for 65 years, nothing was happening, but the Jews in Persia were getting more and more entrenched in Persian society. In the meantime, we've got this, what Rav Lau calls the black hole of time. He calls it a chur shachor, black hole. And in that period of time, he suggests that's when the Purim story took place. And interestingly, he tries to put a date on the rise of Ahasuerus after Cyrus, and he manages to give us dates which correspond quite interestingly to some of the events which are recorded at the beginning of the Megillah. All right, so again, this historical approach suggests that from the year 538 to the year 473 was a very dark period in terms of anything going on in Eretz Israel, and at that period of time there was a changeover from Koresh, Cyrus to Ahasuerus, or as we call him in the history books, Xerxes. Okay, the gentleman who is referred to in many, many historical books on that period. So what happens is that in the year, I think it's 486, Ahasuerus, Xerxes comes to power, right? 486, and we've got 3 years. 3 years of his initial being in power, and we get to the year 483. I'm just running through these dates because I think it's important. And in the year 483, that's essentially when the Megillah begins. Okay, so that's the year that I think is significant, because it says that the first page of the Megillah, it was in the third year of the kingdom of Ahasuerus. Okay, that he made these particular parties. So again, going on number one, just talking about that a little bit more. The question or the item was historical approach, Xerxes and his battles. So what we did point out is that it's recorded 483 till 480, right? 3 years when there were significant battles in the Persian Empire. Anybody wrote down those names? I always forget them. One was called Salamis, which was the really bad one, when I think that was a sea battle when things went really bad. Before that, Pelatia and Thermopylae. Thermopylae is the famous one. Thermopylae is when the Persians tried to take over beat the Greeks, the first battle between Persia and Greece, and there's the famous story of the 300 who managed to hold off the Persian army in a very remarkable military maneuver, which kept the Persian army at bay long enough. That seems that they, in the end, they lost so many troops, they lost so many people. The 300 Spartan soldiers or Greek soldiers, whatever they were, managed to hold them off at a certain point, which they had to go through in order to get to where they were going. And as a consequence of that battle, things started turning a bit bad for Xerxes. And by the time you get to the year 480, right, things are really not looking good for him. He's already been in power for 6 years, coming into his seventh year. Okay, now, any questions on that so far? Because I wanted to make sure that whole thing is understood. Yeah. Yeah, again, you have to look at the. I think I gave you a page from Wikipedia on that, and you have to just look at it again. But the one that 480 is the one that really turned things around more than anything else, which I think was the battle of, Salamis. Salamis in 480 was where the Persian navy was very badly defeated by the Greek navy. Okay, and I think that's one where Ahasuerus really has trouble. And then Thermopylae was the first battle, which clearly was not a great defeat, but was certainly humiliating for the Persians, being held off by a very small number of, at that time, Greek soldiers who in the end were killed, but it was, again, a remarkable event. This is all recorded in, I've forgotten now, the gentleman, the Greek historian, I think Herodotus, if I'm not mistaken. All these names that, you know, sort of you can write down, look them up online and find out who these dudes really were, if that's the way to describe them.
But
yes.
Yes, Salamis
was the one.
Correct.
Affected him the worst because he had to come back after that, and his whole power base was completely changed. Now, in the middle of all of this, and this is really question number two, the background to chapter one, why there are two parties. So the thing that we pointed out in the beginning of the Megillah, which is happening in the third year of Ahasuerus's, of Xerxes' reign, just before he begins his military campaign. So what has he got to do? He's got to raise an army. All right? So in order to raise an army, he invites all the various military people, I guess, the generals and whatever, to Shushan. And he actually makes two parties. And this is something which, if you don't read the Megillah carefully, one tends to miss. Party number one, which lasted for 180 days, and party number two, which came very soon afterwards, which lasted for 7 days. And the whole question is, again, Rav Lau asked this question from a historical perspective, why were there two parties? All right, and we'll see in a minute that the Malbim, for instance, which we did look at, gives a different approach. But Rav Lau's approach is very simple. He says in the year 483, which is when these parties took place, Ahasuerus was trying to build an army. He was building a coalition of different groups so that he can go and take his army and fight, extend the empire into Greece. So in order to do that, he had to bring people to Persia, not necessarily more than a representation. Nowadays, you would say the diplomatic corps would be invited, or the leaders of the army, the navy, whatever, would be invited from different countries, and they came to Persia, to Paras, came to Shushan, and of course he's got to feed them, and he's got to wow them, and he opens up his storehouses, and he shows them gold and silver, kelim, mikelim shonim, and all the big description beginning of the Megillah, of that particular first party. And at that first party, we see Ahasuerus is basically working to build his coalition, bring troops together. So that's the first party, and there's no suggestion at that party that there was anything untoward by the Jewish community at the time, because they weren't necessarily involved with the making of the army, making of the coalition, because, you know, Amisrael were not recognized, certainly out, they were out of Israel, they weren't really a military group as such. Yeah. So he brought them to Persia, brought them to Shushan. So that's party number one, and that makes sense that it will take 180 days. You're bringing, like, you know, the United Nations today, when they open up the UN every September, it takes them a week. Okay, bringing people. Imagine in those days, just to get people to come from all over the Middle East, just to get to Iran and to Persia and to be there would take a long time. So you've got to allow a 6-month period. I think that actually really makes sense. Party number two is a kind of celebration when the army is established and Ahasuerus has got his whole army together. Then for Shushan, right, he makes a second party for 7 days. And that party for 7 days is extremely significant because that's when Am Yisrael do get involved. We are told that the Jews attended the party and they should not have attended the party, and it was a party where they got involved in negative behavior. There was obviously, it wasn't kosher and all the rest of it. And as a consequence of that particular event, that's when the critique at the beginning of the Jewish community began, and the whole Purim story gets going. All right, because remember, the whole time frame of Purim is that 9 years after the party, that's when the trouble really started with Haman. Took 9 years. And one of the incredible comments, I think the Vilna Gaon said, which I think we mentioned, is that the Jewish people, when they're told by Mordechai that what you did 9 years ago has brought the trouble upon you, instead of saying to him, "You must be kidding, that was 9 years ago," they all said, "Wow, that really was something significant that we did. We shouldn't have gone to this party." And they started a process of tshuva, as we know. They started praying and whatever. And the whole story of Purim, that's Vanapuch, that's when the turnaround began. So the whole concept of that second party is the significant gathering of the Jewish people together with everybody else in the palace in Shushan, where clearly things were not as they should have been. They shouldn't have been there. Question, yes. Yeah, Malbim says something slightly different in the sense that he's not looking at the historical context of the army, but what he is saying is Ahasuerus is trying to build his power base, he's making himself more and more indispensable, and the way you do that is a number of things. If you remember what we said, you move your capital to a different place. So apparently the whole thing of Shushan was that it was created as the capital when it wasn't originally the capital of Persia. Let's just see what I've got here. Also, Malbin talks about, you've got it on the page that I gave you, the idea of limited monarchy versus unlimited monarchy. The limited monarchy is very, very limited because of the people having chosen the king. An unlimited monarchy is when the king can basically override whatever anybody says, he can do whatever he wants. All right? And what Ahasuerus was trying to achieve in the first party was, in fact, in the whole story of the parties in chapter 1, was to become an unlimited monarch. That means without restraint, without limitation. Okay? And the whole thing of moving a capital was one of the big issues. He can make the law, he can break the law. That, of course, is significant, says the Malbim, because later on there's a whole problem, which we did highlight in chapter 8, when the Haman is hanged and he's gone. But what do you do with the decree? The decree is made, and it cannot be changed. Okay, so the whole question is, how then do you stop the event which was put into action by Ahasuerus' first decree, which Haman asked him to do, to kill the Jewish population? Right, they have a very big technical problem that this decree still stands, so you've got to override it. But how do you override it? And that's something that we spoke about towards the end a few weeks ago. Yeah? Not so clear. Not so clear. Rav Lau's description is much clearer. All right? I think what the Malbim will say, very simply, is that the second party, how should we say, was more intimate than the first. Okay, one assumes that's where Vashti was called in. You know, the famous Midrash that she didn't want to appear. Wonderful Midrashic sense of humor. Midrash is wonderful because I think the rabbis did have a sense of humor. I really believe that. And, you know, they say, why didn't Vashti want to appear? So everybody knows because he demanded that she come in naked, which she didn't want to do. But the rabbis say, oh, it's another extra problem because she grew a tail. Okay, she actually had this little extra tail which she didn't want to share that particular appearance with the rest of the Persian Empire. As they say nowadays, that would have been a discussion in who knows what magazine, where on the internet it would have been, you know, sort of, it certainly would have trumped Mr. Trump and various other bits of news that go on from day to day. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, when you deal with Midrash, sometimes maybe you have to take them with a little bit of, a little pinch of halachic or midrashic salt. Okay, if you understand what I'm saying, sometimes they're just making the point, slightly exaggerating the point. They say themselves that very often they're open to exaggeration, but for a reason, without going into that particular topic. Yeah,
Chassan. For the second party for Rabbi, what is it, 480 or also
40? Yeah, it's all happening in the same time. It's a week after the first 6 month party, but it's a celebration of completion of his plan. Right? And that's really the whole thing. So the two parties make a lot of sense. And then by the time you get to the end of 483, Xerxes is ready to go to war, Ahasuerus, and that's battle number one. And then you've got battle number two in 482, and then battle number three in 480. And all those battles are not referred to in the Megillah per se, but they do happen historically. And then the Megillah in chapter 2 brings us back to Shushan, after, historically, those battles are done. And the suggestion is why Ahasuerus in chapter 2 seems to be very disconnected, he doesn't seem to be sort of, you know, on top of his game, is because his position in Shushan has been weakened. Okay, and that is because of the historical context of the battles. So again, it all fits in. Right, that's what I like about it, is that I'm taking my history book and my Megillah and actually trying to sort of fit them together, which I don't see, I haven't really seen anyone else do in the more traditional approaches to Megillat Esther. Yeah?
So what you're saying is that those parties in place, and then there's like the 9-year gap?
No, initially there's a 3-year gap, right? Because the The second chapter of Megillah takes place in year 7 of his reign. So just again, he comes to reign 486. He's 3 years establishing himself till 483. Wants to create an army to expand the kingdom in 483. He gets all the people come to Shushan, right? He has two parties, one big one for the diplomats, and then a shebang for everybody else to let the hair down at the end. And by that time, he's got his army together in 483. And for 3 years, he's away fighting these battles. He comes back to Shushan in around the year 480, 479. And that's chapter 2 of the Megillah. Chapter 1 is 483, when he's building his army. Chapter 2, after those wars, when things are beginning to go bad, you get to the year 479. Seventh year of the reign. And we know it's the seventh year because Megillah tells us that. The whole thing of finding a new wife is to do with the fact that, at least in Shushan, he's trying to build himself up again. So he realizes one of the things that will give him more strength is to marry someone, you know, sort of to be seen as a person of greater strength, to have a wife that he can display. You know, the mindset of the Middle East in those days is all about show.
That's also why he chose somebody, because he came back from a war with...
Well, part of it because the war had affected, and he needed to build up his power, at least at home.
But he chose somebody who wasn't from a royal family.
Doesn't matter. The reality was he needed to show that he is, you know, he's the great King Ahasuerus, the great King Xerxes, and in order to do that, you got to have, one of the things you have to have is a very significant queen. Even if she's just there to take pictures for the press, that's all he required. All right? And in fact, on the contrary, the initial suggestion is she kept quiet. I'm going to talk about that in a second, because, you know, if he'd known that she came from such royalty, he wouldn't marry her. That's the Malbim suggestion also. Malbim says because he got rid of Vashti because she came from royalty and she was always putting him down, so now he wants to become an unlimited monarch. So what does he do to marry a new queen? The last thing he wants to marry, last person, is to marry another queen, right? Someone who comes from royalty. And Esther does. She's descended from King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. So the reality of Esther is, initially, everything is just for show, but not for anything else. No sort of background checks, as they say today. Okay? Nothing on Facebook. What a boring world. Actually, I think it's probably a more healthier world than we're living in. I'm not going to start. That's going to detract from this lesson if I start on Facebook. Yes, please. Well, I would say like this. What I probably would ask you in a question, right, without telling you what the question is, but the sort of thing is, compare and contrast two approaches to the Megillah. Right, there is a more traditional approach, okay, which sees it much more without the historical background or historical connection, and then there is a more historical approach. And the historical approach is much more what we're talking about here from Rav Lau, the whole concept of what the Megillah time frame really is. Okay, and they're both valid, but they have different consequences in terms of the nuances of what's going on in the Megillah. I would say not really, but you know, to have some idea of a sort of basic time frame. That there is 3 years that he establishes himself, 3 years for battles, and then the whole story develops with Esther and beyond. And then you get 2 years down the line, you get to the ninth year of Ahasuerus' reign, the 12th year, because it says in the Megillah, the 12th year of Ahasuerus' reign, which is 9 years after that initial meal, initial Suda in Shushan, and that's when the Jews start doing tshuva. Okay, all these numbers are in the Megillah. The seventh year, the 12th year, it's all there. The third year, chapter 1, the third year of Ahasuerus, Vayihibim Ahasuerus, right? It says the third year of his reign. So all of these dates are in the Megillah, and what Rav Lau does is makes them historically relevant, which is why I like what he says. Yes? Oh, yeah. Malbim more traditional, but again, Malbim is not without his historical awareness, but not like Rav Lau. Okay, I always talk about the Malbim. I still believe that he was a very well-read gentleman, and sort of things that he writes in his commentary, he writes about things that he could only have picked up in a library. Right? He knows about Egyptology. He knows a lot of stuff about the ancient Middle East, which he can never have found anywhere except in some sort of library setting, so you must have read quite widely. Some of the rabbis did, I'm glad to say. Some of them didn't, not so good. Alright, and you have to be careful what they say sometimes. Alright, so again, That's number two, and we're looking good. Actually, we're not looking so good because we're taking too much time. Look at number three. All right, so I hope that's clear. One and two, because these are really important. Number three, who were Mordechai and Esther? Different approaches. So again, traditional approach, right? The sort of the rabbinic figure plus Esther, the tzaddikus. And I'm not going to detract from that, because in the end of the day, that's how it comes out. But it may not be so realistic. All right, I'm the first time I taught this, I might mention to you, one of the balabatim, one of the gentlemen in the shir that I was giving, he said he had to sit down with another rabbi and tell him what I was telling them, and the other rabbi was a bit horrified. How can you not say that Mordechai was the god Ladon? And I said, look, if you want to deal with it in that way, in the way that you've dealt with it maybe forever and ever since you started reading Megillat Esther, fine. I don't want to detract from that. But what I want to suggest is maybe just a little bit more realism when it comes to Mordechai and Esther, who they were to begin with. Right? Is there any suggestion at the beginning that Mordechai is this super rabbinic figure that we all think of him as being? And the answer is no. Right? On the contrary, remember we said Rav Lau again suggests this, but I think we found other places as well. As I said, that initial midrash, where Mordechai is a captain or a general even in the Persian army, from that midrash alone, there is a suggestion that Mordechai is not as black and white cookie cutter as we think he is. Right? The reality is that Mordechai is very comes from a very unusual place. He seems to have had a very strong connection to the government of the day, and that again I think is significant to understand that Mordechai is not the person necessarily at the beginning who is the, you know, sort of ultimate rabbinic figure that we would look up to. And the same goes for Esther. And of course, Rav Lau's very controversial suggestion is that they in fact were both assimilated Jews. Okay, very much different to the way we normally think of them. But to begin the process, they start off as being assimilated Jews. Mordechai is Bashar HaMelech. Now, he's not Bashar HaMelech because he's there as a Jew representing the Jewish community. He's there because he's high up in the government. And the proof of that, says Rav Lau, which I think is an interesting thought, is the whole plot with Bigtan and Teresh. And Mordechai can overhear it, he understands it, and he reports it. And again, you'll say to me, okay, so maybe it's the rabbi being diligent, but, you know, you can look at it like that, or you can say he was well connected. And when he heard that the king's life was being threatened, he could make a representation to the king through various channels, and the plot would be foiled. The plot would be stopped. So, different approaches to Mordechai and Esther, the very different approach, which is the historical approach, that they start off being the more secular type of person that we may not think of them as being, but maybe that's what they were to begin with, even to the point where you can say they may have been assimilated at the beginning, like everybody else. Right? The suggestion may even be that they were at the Suda. I think it does say, and maybe again, midrashically, Mordechai was there. So what was Mordechai doing at this very controversial gathering when the Jews were not necessarily observing the rules and regulations of Am Yisrael, of the Jewish people? So Mordechai was there. So again, a lot of interesting speculation about the beginnings of Mordechai and Esther. All right, comments? Yes, please. Yeah, that's again a very big question mark, because according to the Megillah, it seems to be that he was exiled from Yerushalayim, right? But we did say, interestingly, right, that it's not so clear that he is the same Mordechai that is mentioned there, because you've got, according to Rav Lau's timing, you've got a well over 100 years between the events of Purim and the exile from Yerushalayim. So, you know, you're making Mordechai into an extremely old man. Not impossible, right, because there are sort of men of that age are sort of mentioned in different stories, but, you know, sort of doesn't seem to be so likely. So we're talking about Mordechai being a descendant from someone who came from Yerushalayim. Okay, and again, we asked, remember we raised the question, Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Megillah, and again, the suggestion is because of the assimilation of the people. Okay, you don't have to go far to in American society today, in the Jewish world around us, the non-Orthodox world around us, to find Jerusalem is not a comfortable subject to be mentioned. Okay, and this is something which is going on at the moment. It's very disturbing, very worrying. I think the biggest thing we can do, if we have any influence on people around us who are not necessarily observant, is to encourage them to go and visit Israel. Okay, I say that as a suggestion because it really is important. The only way you're going to break through all of the negative stereotyping and everything that people see on TV and hear and whatever stuff that they're listening to or following on Facebook or whatever is by actually encouraging them to go to Israel, particularly people before the age of 26 when it's a free trip. Still is. Not going to be around forever, I'm sure, but at the moment, birthright is still around. Get them to go. So, so important. Okay, you just do not know how that can affect the person's life. And, you know, we all know stories of people who are really affected by it, including students from Stone College as well. All right, so that's number three. So, again, different approaches, and I want to make that point clear. The more traditional, and certainly the more what I'm going to call controversial. Yeah. Well, again, at the beginning, the whole discussion, as we said over here, the anonymity, we're going to come to all of that, all right? We're going to say more about Esther in a minute, because there's still stuff to say. We're on number four. We'll come back to that. Yeah, very quickly.
So, one that's, like, more, like, out there is that they were simulated, and the first one is that Mordecai actually was, like,
Yeah, he had rabbinic credentials, and he represented the Jewish community, and keep it as what I call as parve as possible. All right, that to me is a very parve approach, but it's a very traditional approach, right? And, you know, I'm not telling you here how to think about it because you make up your mind, but I'm just putting it out there because when you think about it, as I said, what was he doing in the Persian army? Okay, I mean, it doesn't say he was a chaplain in the army, it says he was a general in the army. So just go figure. It doesn't really hang together so well to suggest that, you know, here he is, this, let's put it into modern day terms, the great Rosh Hashiva, who's also a general in the Persian army. Right, they didn't have Hezder in those days and those sort of schemes. Certainly not in the Persian army. Have a look at this, number four. So, why did Mordecai refuse to bow? Midrashic background. So again, obviously, we said that there is essentially a number of approaches. We saw that there is the, what did we say? The approach of, different things that we said. The whole question of his identity, we've got the page out. I don't know what we said about the whole thing of him not bowing. Yeah. The whole thing of Mordecai not bowing, remember, right, we did say that traditional approach is because Haman was wearing a Avodah Zarah. He was wearing some sort of idolatrous symbol, okay, which may not necessarily have been anything more than declaring himself to be some sort of idolatrous item himself, right, turning himself to a mini god. And of course Mordecai would never bow to that. But of course the whole question of the Midrashic background, Mordecai would refuse to bow to Haman, as we explain, because of their relationship, which was very significant. Okay, so this is really an important item which we have to stress yet again, which is that when they were in the Persian army together, right, remember the Midrashic background, Mordecai and Haman were both generals in the Persian army, and they were given a certain allowance to buy armor or guns or bows and arrows or whatever it would be in those days, and Haman spends the money, doesn't have any money to equip his particular platoon, and Mordecai makes an arrangement and gives Haman a loan, all right, or gives him money, but calls Haman, remember it says either he doesn't pay him back, or whatever it is, there's not a good relationship afterwards, and Mordecai basically does not think very much of Haman from that time onwards, does not have any respect for him, he really... in fact, if I'm not mistaken, it says there, Haman wrote an IOU. And the IOU was, if I don't pay you back, I become your servant. And of course, now, in the story of Mordecai and Haman, which is developing already from chapter 3 onwards, we already get this sense that Mordecai is sort of cashing in on that particular IOU. Okay, if you're not going to pay me back for what I gave you as a loan, then you become my servant. So now Haman becomes the sort of the big lord of the manor, How is Mordechai ever going to agree to bow down to him when he knows that Haman is his servant? A lord, someone up higher up does not bow down to someone who is beneath him. Okay, so that's the whole issue with midrashically the reason why Mordechai does not bow down to Haman. And of course, you ask the obvious question: isn't this endangering the Jewish people? And the answer is initially no, because it's a personal disagreement between Mordechai and Haman, right? It's between them both. The whole big thing at the beginning is that Haman and Mordechai are not representing anything more than their own particular grouping at the time. Remember when when Haman says, "I'm going to kill the nation of Mordechai." Am Mordechai. Doesn't even say Am Yudi. Right? Becomes bigger picture later on. But at the beginning, it's a very personal vendetta between the two. So that, again, I think is important to understand and to put that into the context of the whole story. All right? Any questions on that? Yes, please. Sorry, again? The lottery later on, we're gonna come to that. Yeah, just hang on a second, because that's already a little bit further on. Number 5, Esther's anonymity, Hamalka. Yes, please.
Wait, so it wasn't endangering the Jews?
Well, initially not, it was personal, right? It became much bigger than that, because Haman realized, right, that Mordechai comes from a group. Remember, Haman is, but in essence, a Molech, and all of that animosity began to take over. Okay, very similar to the way people describe what happened to a certain gentleman, leader of Germany in the early 1900s. Okay, must have had some sort of very negative experience with, who knows, some say it was a Jewish girlfriend, some say it was some sort of a connection he had with the Jewish community in Vienna. And all of the animosity just overtook this gentleman. He became so vile and so disgusting in the end from that initial negativity. Who knows? Initially may have been very personal, but obviously became much bigger than that, with the horrible consequences. One thing here, which I've actually put not in the right order, but number 5 should really become before number 4, Esther's anonymity. Why? Why did Esther refuse, or why was she told not to reveal who she was? We gave a whole bunch of reasons for it, right? Yes, sort of help me out here a little bit. Rashi is the most famous. What does Rashi say? Right, if they know she's from Mishpacha Shaul, what's Rashi's comment? She's from the family of kings, what would they do? Right, in other words, if she doesn't reveal who she is, what are they going to say about her? He can marry her. Why can he marry her? Because she is no threat to him. Okay, she's coming from Mishpacha, which they don't even recognize. They don't even know who she is. She just looks pretty. All right, and therefore he says if they knew that she was from the family of King Shaul, Rashi suggests that they would grab her. Basically, what Rashi seems to be alluding to is the fact that Mordechai was not very keen for Esther to be taken to the palace. Okay, and of course that dovetails very nicely with the very famous opinion, which I've said over here. I didn't mention here, but it has to be mentioned, is the whole question of the relationship between Esther and Mordechai. Right? According to Rabbi Meir and the Gemara, not only were they normally portrayed as uncle and niece, but it turns out Labat means Labayit. Right? That verse 7 of chapter 2 says quite clearly that she was not only his daughter, but in fact his wife. And again, at that point, Mordechai is not so excited for her to be taken to the palace of the king in order to be chosen as one of the wives or the wife of the king, because they're already married. Okay, so Mordechai is giving every opportunity for Esther by being silent about where she's coming from, who she is, so that he can sort of protect her a little bit from being taken to the palace. He doesn't want her to be taken. The other suggestion is quite the opposite, as we said. It's on the page that I gave you on chapter 2, in fact, which says that, if I'm not mistaken who this was, the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says that Mordechai did it so that we can keep quiet that she's Jewish, that she would be in a position where she can avoid eating non-kosher food and stuff like that in the palace, so she didn't reveal who she was. Okay, she doesn't have to sort of make excuses and say that she's Jewish and she doesn't eat it, because the reality there might be that the king will turn around and say, well, you're not for me, And the next thing you know, she's killed. So Mordechai, on the contrary, according to Rashi, Mordechai is protecting Esther, not going to the palace, right? Trying to keep her away from the palace by not revealing who she is, and they still take her. Or according to Ben Ezra, what he's saying is that Mordechai is in fact telling Esther, keep quiet, right? So that when you are taken to the palace, you will be able to maintain a Jewish lifestyle. So for Ibn Ezra, there's no suggestion of Esther it doesn't link up with the whole issue whether Esther was married to Mordechai or not. But certainly, according to Rashi, my feeling is it does link up with that concept. If Esther is married to Mordechai, then it will make a lot of sense for Mordechai not to want Esther to be taken to the palace. Okay, so I think that point is clear. Yeah. Correct. Well, that's it. That's the whole discussion. There's a difference of opinion.
Yeah. So she wants to hide her wealth, so she wouldn't be a threat.
Correct, because that's Rashi. So there's different points of view. Some people see it as a ploy to get her not to go, and some say that on the contrary, she should go, but she should be in a position where she can still maintain her Jewish lifestyle. All right. So if they don't know who she is, she doesn't announce that she's Jewish, then they won't have any sort of issues with her when she says, "I'm not eating supper tonight. I'm feeling a bit off color," or whatever she would say. According to the Kohen Chazal, she was off color, right? When it says that Achashverosh fell in love with her, she had a green complexion, whatever that means. She used the wrong cosmetics. Who knows? It says Yirakrak. It actually says she had a green face. Not sure what to make of that, but anyway, very quickly, 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. Well, that's according to Rashi. Yeah, according to Rashi, no. But according to Ibn Ezra, you can make up your mind. Seemingly, yes. Seemingly, yes. So that's how it seems to work out. Yeah.
So, just quickly, Rashi says that they didn't want her to reveal she was Jewish, that she was from royalty, so she wouldn't have to go to the palace.
Right. Right.
But she ended up going anyway.
She ended up going even without, exactly.
And the second from Ibn Ezra was so that she could keep a Jewish, not to reveal it, so there wouldn't be any problems.
But certainly that she should go to the palace. Ibn Ezra seems to be much more positive about her going.
But and then he gave the example of her eating.
As one of the things will benefit her by keeping anonymous, correct. Yeah. Sorry, again, did they? Well, again, that's a speculation, but it would seem, right, that according to the way Rashi is explaining it, and it doesn't work out with what we actually said in our lesson, right, but Rashi seems to suggest that if she would have been of, he would have known that she's of royal background, he would have taken her as a queen. What we have suggested is quite the opposite, according to the Malbim, who disagrees. And Malbim says quite categorically, if he would have known that she was of royal descent, he would not have taken her. Okay, so that's why, again, another reason why she kept quiet. So, it's interesting just to see how the rabbis take the obvious information and explain it in, essentially, two very different approaches. Okay, so that's important. Yes, come here. I was just going to talk about that.
That's part of the question, but not, that's after.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the whole thing of the use of the word Amalka is significant if we go with the concept that Achashverosh would never have married her if he knew that she was of royal descent. So it's more going with Malbim as opposed to Rashi. All right, if that makes sense. Don't want to make this too complicated, but again, just to keep it in that sphere, what am I saying? That the word Malkah is one of those significant words which, when you get to chapter 5 of the Megillah, becomes really significant because it says, Esther wore Bigdei Malchut, right at the beginning of chapter 5. And Bigdei Malchut, it says she wore Malchut. Doesn't say what Malchut means, she wore kingship. So the rabbis say it means Bigdei Malchut. She put on special clothing. But the suggestion is that King Achashverosh at the time saw when she walked into the room, the way she conducted herself, that she was clearly a bit more than just a regular common farm girl from who knows where. She was really of some sort of royal background. So he's beginning to suspect, even though he doesn't know who she is, by the way Esther conducts herself, and that is expressed in the word Hamalka. When you see the word Hamalka, it's a key word. It drops itself from Vashti as soon as Vashti goes out of favor with the king, and she's not called Hamalka after that. At the beginning she is, but not for much longer. And Esther, they play around with the word Malka. Sometimes the king calls Esther Malka, and sometimes he calls her Esther. And in chapter 5 we explain that is the king deliberating in his own mind about who she is, not really sure about what she is and who she is. Okay, and that, again, look at the notes because I think it's significant. I've got to run through the rest of this stuff. Number 6, how do we fight Amalek? The two parties that Esther makes, Machar, the theme of Amalek coming right back from the story of Yeshua, was that you start and you take time. What do you do in the middle between battle number 1 and battle preparation and battle number 2, or the beginning of preparation followed by waiting 24 hours and then going to battle, is that there has to be some spiritual preparation as well. And the whole idea of Machar. Esther reflects fighting Amalek with the same plan. She does two parties. Everyone says, why does she have to do two parties? Do one party, reveal who she is, and get on with it. The answer is no, because there is a precedent of Machar. Dealing with Amalek has got to be done in that sense of Machar, of waiting a day, as was established both in the story of Yeshua, back in the Torah, and with Shaul HaMelech, also a similar reference as well. So that's number 6 on your page. Number 7, who was Harvona? The issue of miracles, and again we spoke about the tree, and please look at your notes, because that again is significant. Why is Harvona Zocha Latov? Because it's a significant point where the king could have calmed down, and instead of hanging Haman, he could have had a backlash against Esther and Mordechai, but he didn't, because Harvona pipes up with his suggestion about the tree. And of course the Midrashic suggestion, Harvona, is none other than, remind me, who is he really in disguise? Eliyahu Navi. Okay, I love that idea. In the middle of all of this, you've got Elijah just popping in to say hello. Number 8, why kill all the anti-Semites? That was something that the Ibn Ezra raises. After the whole story, when the edict is reversed, right, or the king sends out a new edict, it says that the Jews not only can protect themselves, but they actually have to go out and kill the people who were prepared to kill them. And we ask, why was that necessary? And the answer again is a number of answers that we gave. The one that I like was the fact that it sort of reverses, it's the way of the king saving face. The king can say to everybody, Achashverosh can say, well, I sent out an original edict for the Jews to be attacked, right, or for a people to be attacked, and Haman put it onto the Jewish people, right? He can claim it wasn't even specified at the beginning. If I'm not mistaken, this is how it goes. The king can save face by saying it was really Haman's idea. And how do we know that it was Haman's idea? Because look, now the whole thing has become the Jews not only defending themselves, but they are attacking the enemy. So that proves that from the king's standpoint, it was the Jews attacking the anti-Semites, whereas from Haman's standpoint, it was the other way around. The king is given an opportunity to backtrack on what he agreed with Haman originally, and turns it around to make it look as if it was Haman's idea, but not Achashverosh. We have to get real. Achashverosh did not like the Jewish community. He was not one of the big friends of Israel. Okay? As today, you have leaders in the world. Some are friends, and some really are not, as we know. Just very briefly, number 9. Background to the Purim holiday. The effect of community. Some of you said towards the end, all the mitzvot of Purim create a communal situation, because Am Yisrael learn the lessons of coming together as a community, Mishlach Manot, Matanot Yevanim, is not only a religious response, which can be reflected in the reading of the story, etc., etc., and getting drunk, and all of that stuff, right, which reflects a more religious type of response to what's going on, but there is a communal response, that we, our strength is in our communal lives, right, we come together on Purim and reflect that element, which again is really, really important. Avera Lishma, we spoke about that literally last week, so I hope I don't have to go over that again. The whole question of Esther continuing with Achashverosh, and then the writing of the story, Esther's problem of getting the rabbis to agree to allowing her to write the story. We spoke about that as well, and I hope that's still fresh in your mind. And the other observation, that right at the end, the 11th chapter of the Megillah, which is what Rav Lau brings it all back and says that the consequence of Megillat Esther is in fact the rededication of the Second Temple, the rebuilding, or rather the building of the Second Temple completed, and Nehemiah returns to Eretz Israel on the allowance of the king at the time, who happens to be the son of Esther. Okay, some amazing sort of conclusion to that particular cycle. And as a consequence, we have what he calls the 11th chapter of the Megillah, which is the second chapter of the book of Nehemiah, which we went through last week. Please look at your notes. We did this very quickly. I apologize, I spent a lot of time at the beginning, but it was important to get that framework clear in your mind. Okay, so we've put, essentially, I look at this as a bit of Torah Mother. We've taken a bit of science, a bit of history, and we've sort of synthesized it with a story that you all know so incredibly well, and shown you that it's not a story in isolation, but it is a story in the tapestry of history, which is clearly much bigger than just the focus on one particular event in Persia. It's got much bigger ramifications for the whole world at that time. Okay, and I want that to be clear, and I hope that was the chidush, that was the revelation of what we studied in Megillat Esther, something which I hope became something novel for you, something to take away, even to the point where you may even talk about this in a few months' time when we get to Purim. Remember, it's a leap year this year, so we're going to have to wait a few weeks more than we normally wait. Yeah, final comment. Unlikely. No. The whole thing of the lottery, not again, if it's there, it's going to be a very small part of a question. What I would say to you is that if you cover this particular amount of information as well as you can, what's on the sheet here and what we went through, and again, with apologies about sort of the balance that we kind of lost at the end, I think that should set you up pretty well to answer the 5 out of 6 questions. Okay? Any final comments before you all disappear? Yes. No. Again, you can certainly, if you want to mention who said what, but everything can be in English. But what I would say to you is, again, certain parts of the story, a phrase out of the text, right? Mishlach manot ish l'reyeh, just to quote that particular pasuk, when you're talking about the effect of community as a result of the laws of Purim, that is a nice little embellishment to your answer, right? And that's a good way to get you into my good books, if that is required, which you never know. Always good for insurance. Everybody, I wish you well. See you all on that Sunday. Just sit down for a second. Just want to say one thing. This has been very challenging because it's a big group. And it's been challenging for a lot of reasons, just trying to sort of keep ahead of you guys. But, right, at the same time, I always tell my students, and I want this to be absolutely understood, that you think you've sat here and learned from me. I've learned a lot, probably more from you than you can ever imagine. Just by your questions, from your essays, it's really exciting, right? What I'm in a position where, you know, I can benefit, and I have benefited so much over the years from all the different classes that I've been teaching, and I'm excited for next semester teaching Book of Ruth, Book of Yonah. These are two books, again, which I haven't taught here before. So if it excites you a little bit, then I look forward to seeing you. Certainly look forward to seeing you at the exam. And wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. Have a good Shabbos, everybody. Thank you. This will go online very soon, and I hopefully, Blineda, will send the link to you. Thank you, everybody. Have a good day.